Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasing isolation of Saudi Arabia as more and more evidence points to the Saudi Crown Prince, MBS, as the person responsible for ordering the assassination and gruesome murder and dismemberment of a Saudi American journalist in Turkey. David Hurst, the editor of the Middle East Eye, joins us from London to discuss his latest article, Trump and the Boy King, Mohammed bin Salman's reign is over before it even began. And although MBS has moved ruthlessly to control Saudi Arabia's three militaries and intelligence services and is conducting a reign of terror against his fellow princes, we'll assess the likelihood that international pressure on the Saudi royal family will eventually mean that MBS will not become their next king. As David Hurst points out in his article, if Khashoggi's death was an act of insanity, a total madman must have ordered it, not to mention that it was an act of barbarity you would expect from ISIS. We will also look into the similarities between the two pampered, arrogant, and incompetent princes, Jared Kushner and MBS, who claims he has Trump's son-in-law in his pocket, and the likelihood that Kushner gave MBS a classified list of the Crown Prince's critics, who were later arrested, tortured, and had their fortunes confiscated. Then we will speak with the policy director of the nonpartisan National Election Defense Coalition, Susan Greenhalgh, about the brazen voter suppression going on in Georgia, where the Republican Secretary of State running for governor is rigging the election in his favor. We'll also address concerns about Russian interference in the November election and the puzzling inaction by Republicans and the Trump administration to ensure our vulnerable election systems are protected, particularly since there is evidence the Russians likely hacked the vote in North Carolina's Durham County in 2016 and got away with it because of a lack of interest on the part of Trump's Department of Homeland Security to look into it. Then finally, we will speak with Greg Sargent, who writes the Plumline blog at the Washington Post, about his new book just out, An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. He joins us to discuss the dilemma facing the Democrats, many of whom are seething at the ruthless GOP tactics used to get Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, as they face a choice whether to follow Michelle Obama's advice that, quote, when they go low, we go high, or take the gloves off and stop bringing a butter knife to a knife fight. And joining us now from London is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who formerly was the chief foreign leader writer for The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, and European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. And his latest article at Middle East Eye is Trump and the Boy King, Mohammed bin Salman's reign is over before it even began. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hi.
So, David, if there's a note of confidence in what you're saying here, my understanding is indeed that even though he's conducting a kind of reign of terror, MBS, and it's aimed at the elite, which Khashoggi represented, and they're all terrified, my sense is that they've got to be. This is not the way the Saudi royal family has ever done business. So where do you see this counter coup, if you will? Even though he's proactive, and obviously the fact that he arrested all these top princes, or many of them, had a chilling effect amongst the thousands of princes, many of whom are going to be very unsettled by what MBS is doing, and it's likely because of the global reaction to him, he's likely to get more and more isolated, isn't he?
Well, I think they're panicking at the moment. I mean, before directly answering your question, it's worth just going over a really series of threats and counter-threats that are ramping up today on Sunday. It started with the BBC, who reported that the UK and the US are considering boycotting this so-called Davos in the desert. This is his future investment initiative. That was the sort of rollout to the power of Mohammed bin Salman a year ago. And now both the U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and the U.K. International Trade Secretary Liam Fox might not attend, along with a host of media companies, New York Times, Financial Times.
With the exception of Fox Business.
With the exception of Fox, yes. That would be interesting if Fox actually pulled out of that one. Then you've got a really tough statement by the British, French and German foreign ministers saying that they are insisting on a credible investigation into the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. This is, of course, after Saudi Arabia joined, so-called joined, a joint investigation by Turkey, but has still to allow Turkish forensic specialists into the room and the console where Khashoggi was allegedly murdered and then cut up like an animal. And now what you've got is a statement by the Saudis saying the kingdom would retaliate against any sanctions with even greater action. And that has been detailed by a guy called Turki Al-Dakhil, who's the general manager of Al Arabiya news channel. And he's basically Mohammed bin Salman's right-hand man. And he has promised a whole series of, he's made a whole series of threats, including doubling or even tripling the price of oil, inviting the Russians into a military base in Tabuk, in northwest Saudi Arabia, and to stop buying weapons from the U.S. and pull out of investments in the U.S. government, he said, which reaches $800 billion. I've never heard of that figure before. I thought it was $500 billion. But they really must be panicking. I mean, they're panicking because it's now very, very obvious that the Turks have got the evidence that they claim they have, and they're just about to show it. But it's the audio and the visual tapes of Jamal's Khashoggi's very last moments. Now, going back to your question, the sort of internal dynamics of this, you're right. What happened before Mohammed bin Salman came along was a new king took over. But he spread the goodies around. He made sure that all the various branches of the family were happy. He either bought them off or he gave them the interior ministry. There are about three armies in Saudi Arabia, and he gave one of them to another branch of the family. When King Salman came in, he initially did the same thing and shared out the goodies and made collective decisions. But as soon as he put his son in pole position, things started to change very, very quickly. And he directed, a few weeks after the first Davos in the desert, in fact, exactly the same place in which they held this investment conference in the Ritz-Carlton, he invited all the princes and the businessmen to a meeting, to an audience. And they walked into the place and then found themselves staying there longer than they'd expected. And some of them were mistreated and some of them were very badly tortured. And so, and this was directed at, I mean, the cover for this was an anti-corruption drive. But in fact, what was happening was that he was shaking down specific branches of the family, the Bin Abdullahs, the Bin Talals, and leaving other very corrupt parts of the family, like Bandar, who's the former ambassador to the United States under Bush, and his elder brother, leaving them entirely free. So they hate him. The family hates him. But he's in total control. They're very, very frightened of opening their mouth. And it really is coming up to something like a reign of terror. He does have support in some sections of Saudi Arabia. I mean, he's supported by the youth. But the feeling is that the moment they are forced to open their wallets and pay for the austerity measures that are now currently sweeping the kingdom, he will lose his popularity. This is a prince. Everything he touches goes wrong, including assassinating a very mild, mannered and intellectual and loyal journalist who didn't happen to like what was going on in Saudi Arabia, but he was loyal to, he hated being called a dissident, he was loyal to the kingdom.
And again, I'm speaking with David Hurst, who is in London. He's the editor of Middle East Eye, formerly the chief foreign leader writer for The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. And his latest article at the Middle East Eye is Trump and the Boy King, Mohammed bin Salman's reign is over before it even began. And of course, David, we know that the Trump administration made a massive investment in Saudi Arabia. That was Trump's first overseas trip just recently before the United Nations, when he made a total fool of himself saying how great he was and he'd accomplished more than any previous president in American history. He then went on to praise three countries after he trashed just about everybody else. He praised Israel, Poland, and Saudi Arabia. And The Intercept is reporting, and some others are reporting as well, the story that it looks like the conference that you talked about at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel before that conference, he had held all of those princes prisoner. The allegation is that Jared Kushner gave MBS a list that he got from classified sources in the United States of dissident or critical princes, and many of those were the ones that were beaten, tortured, and had were extorted and had their wealth confiscated. What's your sense about that report? It hasn't been pinned down. Of course, Kushner denies it. But I see a kind of symmetry there between Kushner and MBS. They're both sort of little princes, entitled, arrogant, and frankly, incompetent.
Well, yes. Saudi Arabia sort of recognized its own image when it dealt with Trump and his son-in-law, because it was just one family dealing with another family. And that's the way they do it. It wasn't government to government. It wasn't institution to institution. It was one power broker dealing with another power broker. I think they were both attracted by each other's ignorance and each other's inexperience in foreign affairs. They exchanged an awful lot of information. I mean, Kushner has Netanyahu and Israel behind him. And one of the aspects of the relationship between, the personal relationship between Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman is the so-called deed of the century, which basically we know now what that consists of, and it would be an absolute disaster for the Palestinians. It would also be pretty disastrous for Israel as well. But that relationship is key, and I think one of the things that the Trump family, Donald Trump and Kushner now have to reckon with is that they very much put Mohammed bin Salman in power. They very much approved of him. They promoted him. When King Salman took over, his elder cousin was crown prince. That's Mohammed bin Nayef. And he was a favorite of the American security establishment. And what Trump and Kushner did was help Saudi Arabia ease him out and install bin Salman as the new boy, as the crown prince. So it's very, very much Trump's doing. And what he's finding now is that the guy that he, the fulcrum of his whole relationship with Saudi Arabia, the pushback against Iran, and all his Middle East regional policies, the personification of that, which is this prince, has done something that is that would be the equivalent of a killing that ISIS, the Islamic State, would have done. It's roughly the same mentality. You take an innocent person, you humiliate them, you torture them, and then you cut them up like an animal. That's roughly what Islamic State have done as well. It's the same mentality. So this is a total international outrage. The murder was allegedly committed with state resources on state premises. So it's a special team of hitmen that came, that was assembled from special forces. there was an expert there, a forensic expert, a doctor who's expert at cutting up bodies. I mean, you know, you don't assemble a group of 15 people like that. The cover story is they were tourists. They arrived on two private planes, they only stayed there for the best part of 15 hours. I mean, it was not so very quick tourism if they were tourists. And they were obviously a murder squad. I mean, very obviously. This wasn't even an attempt to kidnap Jamal Khashoggi. This was murder, absolute murder. It happened very, very quickly. It happened from 1:14 when he walked into the consulate to 3:15 when the first convoy of cars came out of it. And in that time, he walked in, he was interrogated, killed, and then his body was disposed of. So
all of it recorded, I believe, on his Apple phone, which was sent to a server.
Yes, either that, or that is a cover story for
the Turks.
For the Turks,
who've got the place wired. Yeah, yeah. I had heard earlier from...
There's also some interesting detail, because the Turks told me that... Turkish intelligence told me that the team had gone around taking all the hard drives out of the surveillance system in the consulate. Every room is covered with a CCTV to destroy the evidence, which is why they couldn't show Reuters, when they invited them in, film of Khashoggi walking out of the place, because that's what they alleged. They alleged that within 20 minutes of his arrival, he walked out a free man, and then they didn't know what happened to him, and the Turks must have kidnapped him. And they said, oh, we've got film to prove it. When the Reuters correspondent, whom they invited in to show all these empty rooms to, asked for the film and said, oh, sorry, the cameras aren't working. Well, the reason the cameras aren't working is because the hit squad took all the hard drives out of the system. So my feeling is that the visuals come from the system itself that recorded it, and that... and that the Turks probably tapped into. But that's just speculation. I don't know. It could have happened through his through the Apple Watch, although the distance between the watch and his and the phone that his fiancée kept outside as she was waiting for him to emerge is quite a distance. So sure. I'm not sure whether... in that case or not.
It's much more likely that the MIT enslaved the systems inside. But just in closing, in your article, David Hurst, Trump and the boy king Mohammed bin Salman's reign is over before it even began. Just a quote from your article: if Khashoggi's death was an act of insanity, a total madman must have ordered it, a man for whom there was no rationality, no rules, no restraint, a man who could act with total impunity and from whom no one is safe. So just in closing, your prediction, I take it, is that there will be blowback within the kingdom itself. It may take a while, but in the meantime... do you think Trump's going to fold? I mean, his initial response was quite...
I think Saudi is under a tremendous pressure. This is no longer a spat between Turkey and Saudi, both of whom treat their journalists appallingly. This now is the world versus Saudi Arabia. So the dimensions of the dispute are really blowing up all the time. There is a way out, and the way out of this is not for Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to cut relations with each other, but for the U.S. to quietly press the king to ditch his son. And that would require quite a lot of pressure. But it's possible for America and Trump to get on with Saudi Arabia, but without... bin Salman as the crown prince. So that would involve virtually another palace coup. I'm not sure whether that's possible, because he has retained so much power. He's in charge of all three armies that Saudi Arabia has. But we're in a very, very volatile situation. And what we're seeing, basically, is the jewel in the crown of Trump's Middle East policy imploding, and imploding within the space of about a week.
Couldn't happen to a nicer guy and his son-in-law, as far as I'm concerned. But I thank you for joining us, David Hurst.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I'm speaking with David Hurst, who's in London. He's the editor of Middle East Eye. He was formerly chief foreign leader, writer for The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent. And his latest article at the Middle East is Trump and the Boy King. Mohammed bin Salman's reign is over before it even began. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Republican candidate for governor and secretary of state is rigging the election in his favor in Georgia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Susan Greenhall, who is the Policy Director at the Nonpartisan National Election Defense Coalition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Greenhall.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, Susan. And I don't quite know where to begin because there's so much brazen voter suppression going on. It's particularly disgraceful, I think, in the very close race for the U.S. Senate in North Dakota, where the Republican legislature just passed a law meaning that you couldn't vote if you had a post office box. And almost all of the Native Americans, which is a big part of the population of North Dakota on reservations, have post office boxes. So that's just one example. But I guess the most brazen example is what's happening in Georgia. Would you agree?
I think the new rule that the Secretary of State is putting in place is very worrisome because it's disproportionately impacting minority voters to have their opportunity to vote on Election Day. I think it's going to give the Republican Secretary of State who runs the elections an advantage in his gubernatorial bid, and it's not appropriate for the person who's running elections to be putting in place rules which will advantage his chances to win.
Could you briefly describe what he's doing and lawsuits trying to stop him and whether they'll be successful?
Sure. There's been a rule put in place that requires an exact match of the information on a voter registration form to match information that the state's office have in place in for instance, in your address, if you have it written down as road RD as opposed to RD period, your voter registration form will be held up, and this could potentially impact 53,000 or more voters, according to the Associated Press. 70% of which are estimated to be minorities, meaning that those people will have difficulty voting on Election Day if they don't have proper identification, and they may be required to cast a provisional ballot, which then needs to be adjudicated and potentially might not be counted. This also is going to potentially impact voters that are voting absentee more because they won't have an opportunity to go and cure their voter registration any discrepancies to address them, because right now Georgia does not have adequate curing rules in place. And the Abrams campaign is actually encouraging a lot of people. That's Stacey Abrams. She's Secretary of Kemp's challenger, the Democratic challenger. So there is expected to be a large number of Democratic voters voting absentee, and they could be potentially very affected by this rule that Secretary Kemp has put in place.
So in other words, my address is an avenue, but if I sometimes write AVE, an abbreviation of avenue, if I had one or the other on the original form, I'd be disqualified.
That's correct. Or even if you have your street, whatever, if it's Mockingbird, mm-hmm. whatever, and then it says space, as opposed to just one space, that could hold your voter registration up and give you problems on Election Day voting.
So this is happening quite a bit, and it's obviously there's no excuse for it. I mean, I can't imagine. I'm sure somehow Kemp has offered up some excuse, but it's so absurd and so obvious and so flagrant. Tell me, though, about some of the work that you did back in 2016, particularly in Durham County in North Carolina, because there's a concern that the Russians could help Trump out again, as they did in 2016, this time meddling even more in the elections, because we know that Trump's afraid of impeachment, and that would happen, or that would be triggered if the Democrats take the House and possibly the Senate. So just tell us that it was never properly reported and covered that the Russians actually did something. You know, DHS, Homeland Security, said no, they didn't do anything. They just explored possibilities of meddling in 22 states, I think, but they didn't actually pull the trigger. My understanding is that they may well have pulled the trigger in North Carolina in 2016.
The problem is we don't know. But what we do know is that according to the Department of Homeland Security, the intelligence community, the Russian intelligence was probing voter registration databases across the country and states across the country. We know for sure they did it in 21 states. DHS has even said they probably were in more states. It's just that DHS didn't have visibility into those states' networks, meaning that they didn't have any of their systems operating in that area so that they would see any activity. And we were told that in those cases, no voter registration information was in any way deleted or manipulated or tampered with. However, what we do know is that in Durham County, North Carolina, there were a lot of people on Election Day that had difficulty voting because their voter registration records were had some issue. A lot of people were told that their address had been changed when they had not changed it. People showed up to vote, and they were told that they had already voted absentee when they had not, or that they had voted during early voting. There were a lot of problems with the voter registration records, so much so that the state had to pull the voter registration records, which are provided electronically. In North Carolina, they use what's called electronic poll books. It's basically an iPad that has your voter registration record in it. So that's something that, and that record is digital. That means it's susceptible to a cyber attack. They pulled the iPads out of use, and they used paper poll book backups, and because of this problems, because the records were so corrupted, causing chaos at the polls, that they had to extend polling hours in Durham County for people that were voting. Because of this, there was a lawsuit that was filed to extend the polling hours because there were long lines, people were turned away. People show up to go to vote at 7 a.m. and they can't go back in the evening because they have to pick up their kids, or they have to work, or they have other obligations. So if you can't vote in the morning, that may actually potentially effectively disenfranchise that voter. What was really disturbing is that there were all these issues with the electronic poll books in Durham County, but we found out it was actually reported a month before the election, although the vendor wasn't named, that a vendor of electronic poll books had been targeted with a spear phishing attack by Russian intelligence. After the election, we found out via the NSA, the leaked NSA document that people may recall made a lot of news in around June of 2017.
Right, The Intercept, Reality Winner.
Correct. Reality Winner, the woman that went to prison for leaking the document from NSA, was regarding that attempted hack of VR systems. In that document, NSA concludes that they don't know how far they got or if anything was done. So what we have, the pieces that we have are that we know that the Russian government did have an intention to influence the election. That's according to the intelligence community. We know that Russian foreign intelligence were targeting the vendor of these electronic poll books. We know that the electronic poll books failed profoundly on Election Day in Durham County, which is a very important county in a purple state, and that people weren't able to vote. And we don't know if there's any direct connection between all of those things. At the time, the county did a very rudimentary investigation. They did not consider that malware could have, malicious software or some sort of cyber attack could have played a part in the problems with the voter rolls on Election Day. The state, when the Reality Winner story came out many months later in June, said that they were going to launch its own investigation. That's never been released. There's been no indication that they have called in Department of Homeland Security. I know immediately after the election, the state and the county said that they didn't need to call in Homeland Security to see if this actually could have been some sort of attack. So I think there are a lot of questions still about what happened in Durham County, North Carolina, on Election Day.
And isn't it a fairly predominantly African-American county?
I'm not sure of the demographics that way, but I do know that it's an urban area which tends to
vote Democratically.
Right. So that would have had an impact on that state overall. I think that what's going to be concerning is when we see problems with voter registration databases. There was a 118,000 voter records were incorrectly erased in Los Angeles during the primary a few months ago. There's always going to be a question as to, is this just typical software glitches and problems, or is there something else going on? Because messing around with voter registration database records is definitely a potential way to impact voters on Election Day and try to influence an election. And the most important thing for people to remember is don't panic. There's hotlines you can call. The Our Vote, 866 Our Vote Election Protection Hotline on Election Day for help. Report problems, make sure people know about them, and to always make sure that you vote a provisional ballot if you absolutely cannot get a regular ballot. But always try to get a regular ballot first.
Well, of course, whenever you have any of these attacks, whether they are the DNC or Podesta's email, as the GRU, the Russian military intelligence, did, I think you have to assume, don't you, Susan Greenhall, again, the policy director of the Nonpartisan National Election Defense Coalition, don't you have to assume that it's only when the Russians get sloppy that they get caught? So they're not necessarily sloppy all the time, are they?
I guess I think that from some things I've heard, seems to have been intentions that they wanted to send a signal in 2016 that they were that their presence was there. I'm not an intelligence expert on that level, so I'm only limited to what I've read in the papers.
Right. No, it's true that there's also they left breadcrumbs as well.
Yeah.
But so just let's go back to what can be done here. We've got about 3 weeks left here, and we know that Heidi Huntkamp's race is very tight for the Senate in North Dakota, and yet they've taken away her vote in a very obvious way from the Native Americans, who are a big part of her support. What can she do? Tracy Abrams do in running against this governor who's also the or wants to be governor, the Secretary of State in Georgia, who's just so absolutely, you know, contemptuous of democratic norms and is resorting to this brazen attack. What, you know, I don't want to feel like the Democrats are victims. That's not how democracy should work.
Yeah, well, it's unfortunate that in the instance of like Georgia, the Secretary of State holds so much authority in running elections. I think there is a lawsuit that's been filed by Campaign Legal Center and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law in Georgia challenging this match. Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, had tried something like this a few years ago. He was sued at that time for it being a violation of the Voting Rights Act and the National Voter Registration Act. He settled. They ceased the practice, and then it's come back again with the help of the legislature passing a law to support it. So now there's another lawsuit challenging it. We'll see if they're able to prevail and help these voters. But there are different organizations out there, like the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which is one of the leading organizations for the Election Protection Coalition, and that's a good place, a good resource for voters to contact if they're having problems with their voter registration. People should all be checking their voter registration to make sure that they're still on the voter rolls and that everything is correct and they know where to go on Election Day. And if you can, in the future, things that can prevent these types of problems are supporting laws for same-day voter registration. Certain states, like Wisconsin, have same-day voter registration, and if, God forbid, something happens to your voter registration record, even if it's something as malicious as a malicious cyber attack, it's not a problem because you just re-register on the spot. Sure. And you can vote anyway.
Well, we ran out of time, Susan Greenhall, but I just wanted to make the point that none of this would be happening, particularly in Georgia, if the Chief Justice, John Roberts, had not eviscerated the Voting Rights Act, taking out Section 5. The Kemp in Georgia would not be able to do what he's doing had Section 5 still be active. So that's something to consider. I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Susan Greenhall, who's the policy director at the nonpartisan National Election Defense Coalition. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of the new book just out, An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Greg Sargent, who writes the Plumline blog at The Washington Post. Previously, he wrote for New York Magazine and The New York Observer, Talking Points Memo, and numerous political websites. And his latest book just out is An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Greg Sargent.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And obviously, after the Democrats got rolled over Kavanaugh by a kind of a thuggish determination on the part of Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley to get Kavanaugh on the court, There's been some hand-wringing going on, and now Michelle Obama's advice that when they go low, we go high is being questioned. Eric Holder, the former Attorney General, says when they go low, we kick them. And, of course, Michael Abernathy says when they go low, I say hit back harder. And then, as you mentioned in your article, Hillary Clinton says you cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for. So where do you see this debate at the moment amongst the Democrats? It seems that the progressive wing are really furious. And I guess the, for want of a better description, the corporate wing, they seem to be pretty mute at this point. So who's going to win the argument, let alone win in November?
Well, so, you know, I think this argument among Democrats is sort of inevitable, right? And what's really at its core, it's sort of widely misrepresented in the press, but what's really at its core is fundamental questions about how procedurally radical Democrats should be in the face of Republican counter-majoritarian tactics and Trump's illiberal authoritarian politics. What the left is essentially saying is, you know, not we're furious and we've got to act that way. But, I mean, yes, they are angry. But what they're actually saying to the more cautious centrist Democrats is you need to recognize what you're up against here. And I think this debate, it's sort of hard to say how it's going to go. I don't think, you know, first of all, it'll only really play out in a serious way if Democrats regain power, right? I mean, you know, there's really kind of a lot of limits on what they can do in the minority, even though this debate does unfold there, too. But it'll become much more of a pressing debate if Democrats have to decide things like, you know, how they handle it if they're able to pass progressive legislation into law and the Supreme Court overturns it on frivolous legal theories, or, you know, if the minority Republicans in this scenario filibuster endlessly, in which case Democrats will have to decide whether to do away with the filibuster on legislation. So, you know, I think this is right now there's a lot of positioning going on. So what guys like Abernathy are trying to do, and maybe Holder a little bit less so, they're trying to position themselves in for that future debate. And I think we'll have to have that debate then, but it doesn't strike me as really that urgent right now.
Well, of course, Trump is trying to set a trap for them by saying that they're a mob. So how do they navigate that trap?
Well, my personal preference here would be for Democrats to essentially not take the bait on that stuff, you know. There's no sense in sort of saying, no, Mr. Trump, we're not actually an angry mob, right? That actually, you know, plays into Trump's hands more. My sense is that what Democrats should just do is brush it aside, just sort of say, well, you know, you're the crazy person who's tearing the country in half. Here's what will happen if Democrats take over. We'll exercise real oversight on your corruption and your abuses, and we'll function as a real check where Republicans have given you, you know, free rein to essentially, you know, trample the country and destroy our democracy. So I wouldn't take the bait. You know, the angry mob thing is just a cooked-up talking point. It's basically nonsense.
Well, we, of course, here in California have some key races, and California could go a long way to flipping the House. There are 14 Republican congressmen in California who voted for the big tax giveaway to the ultra-rich, which they call the middle-class tax break. And that had the effect of raising the taxes here in California because they took away the deduction for state and local taxes in a very obvious and petty way to punish a successful blue state. So
right.
They're running on this, believe it or not, you know, because it's a fact-free zone. The endangered Republicans saying the Democrats want to raise your taxes. They've raised your taxes. They want to raise the taxes on gasoline, et cetera, and that they're all tied to Nancy Pelosi. They say they show these kind of scowling, unflattering pictures of Nancy Pelosi next to the Democrats who are running against them. Why don't the Democrats point out the obvious, that the reason that the Republicans are trying to demonize Nancy Pelosi is that she's effective?
Well, you know, I don't really understand the Pelosi strategy. I haven't really seen anything persuasive that shows that it works. I mean, if I recall correctly, you know, they've used the demonized Pelosi strategy in races like the special election in Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, in a district that Trump carried by 20 points. It didn't seem to work too well there. You know, even in the races where Republicans have won, the special elections, the special House elections they've won, in which they've also used the strategy, you know, the Democrats vastly outperformed relative to you know, the partisan makeup of the district. And so I think it's just sort of a, you know, what it really tells us is they can't run on what they've actually done. You know, the tax cut was supposed to be a miraculous political winner for them, and it isn't. And, you know, they cycled that out of their ads everywhere. And, you know, in the cases where they do run on taxes, as you point out, they just lie about what they actually passed. And by the way, it's worth pointing out that this is not even remotely new, right? Like, you know, Republicans have been calling Democrats tax hikers for decades, and it doesn't matter what the actual tax hike in question is. When Obama wanted to end the tax cuts for the very top during that debate over extending the Bush tax cuts, they, of course, just called that a tax hike. And Republicans don't ever say who's actually seeing the tax hike because they can't. They have to lie about it.
But just going back to the Kavanaugh hearing, which definitely has got a lot of progressive Democrats just fuming. A lot of them are fuming against Chuck Schumer, who was a big gift to the Republicans by saying up front that they would do anything to stop Kavanaugh getting on the court. And, of course, the Republicans keep referring to that. And, of course, Michael Avenatti, by promising the so-called third woman would be the kill shot to put Kavanaugh out of business. It fizzled, or it wasn't even delivered. So in your book, you suggested a lot of the problems we have in this uncivil war, taking back our democracy in an age of Trumpian disinformation and Thunderdome politics, is at the feet of the Democrats. But I think there's also surely this structural problem that because of the Electoral College and because of demographics, estimates are by 2040, the Republicans will have 70 Senate seats to the Democrats' 30 Senate seats, simply because Democrats are moving into cities, largely in blue states. As we learned from the last election, Hillary Clinton got over 3 million more votes, but they didn't count. That's the trajectory we're on. So there's some deeper structural problems that don't lend themselves to easy answers.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, you know, the victory of Kavanaugh, the successful confirmation of Kavanaugh needs to be looked at in this context that you're pointing to, right? You know, we're seeing an era of minority rule here in which presidents who have, you know, didn't win, who lost the popular vote, have now picked four of the Supreme Court justices on the court, although in fairness, Bush did win the popular vote re-election. But at the same time, as you say, there's this enormous imbalance in the Senate, which means that a lot of these justices have been confirmed by senators who represent a minority of Americans. And so in that context, you now have a conservative majority, which was, you know, in many ways, the creation of a minority. And they are then going to further entrench Republican minority rule and Republican counter-majoritarian tactics by failing to police gerrymandering, which, you know, could essentially create a situation in which Republicans have outsized representation in the House as well in the next decade. And, you know, the conservative majority will not strike down further voter suppression tactics that Republicans use, probably no matter how bad they get. Although, you know, we'll have to see on that front, but that seems like a perfectly likely possibility. And so we're getting deeper and deeper into minority rule here. And at a certain point, this feeds back into what you brought up earlier about the pressure on Democrats to become more procedurally aggressive and radical. The more Republicans dig in with counter-majoritarian tactics, the harder it's going to be to argue to the left of the Democratic Party that they're wrong about getting radical procedurally, they'll point out, well, look what they're doing. You're just going to sit there and take it, and in many ways, they're going to be right.
Right, but the Democrats are going to win the trifecta again. And frankly, when they have the trifecta, as they did in 1992 with Bill Clinton having the House, the Senate, and the White House, they didn't get a lot done. And 2 years later, in 1994, there was the Gingrich blowback. And the same happened with Obama in 2008. He didn't get a lot done in 2010, and then the Republicans took over during at a census year, gerrymandered, got all the state legislatures to start gerrymandering, and that right. went a long way to this situation that we're talking about. I'm beginning to wonder, though, that all of this sort of, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking about Kavanaugh and how injudicious he was in that extraordinary performance he put on, weeping and calling this the revenge of the Clintons, and all of that behavior, where some pundits are saying, well, you know, he's not suitable for the Supreme Court. I'm not sure that he is suitable for this majority, because I think at some point or other we've got to stop kidding ourselves about Alito and John Roberts in particular and all of these ultra-conservative Republicans that now have the 5-4 majority. They are political operatives. It was John Roberts who got rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Well, you can see exactly what's happening now in Texas. You can see what's happening in Georgia, which we talked about earlier in the program, which is just extraordinary. And then, of course, in North Dakota, they took away – this was done through the state legislature, but they took away the ability of Native Americans to vote through their post office boxes. And that's
just incredibly brazen stuff, really extraordinarily brazen.
And all of that stuff, with it perhaps the exception of North Dakota, would have been prevented had Section 5 still been in there. And then, of course, Citizens United, another of the Roberts Court's opinions, that has clearly given the Republicans an enormous advantage with dark money. So do you think that would be useful to stop, just to take the scales off our eyes and to recognize that this court, these guys in black robes are political operatives, stop kidding ourselves? And I'm not suggesting I know what the answer is. Maybe you got to go back to FDR stacking the court. But
here's what I'd say about it. First of all, you're absolutely right in terms of removing the scales from our eyes, right? And this goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is that you need to look at the Kavanaugh successful confirmation of Kavanaugh in this larger context in which Republican counter-majoritarian tactics are getting more and more entrenched. You could see this 5-4 majority, you know, refuse to police gerrymandering, creating more minority rule in the House in the next decade, and refuse to strike down increasingly onerous voter suppression tactics, also, you know, entrenching minority rule and counter-majoritarian techniques. So, you know, like I say, that's going to, if and when that happens, it's going to be a lot harder to say to progressives, you know, cool it, right? They're going to have a very strong case along the lines of the one you just made. And my guess is Roberts has to know this, and he's going to be mindful of it. Now, I don't endorse court packing in the book. I suggest, you know, reforms along the lines of ones that have you know, been embraced by people in both parties that would term limit Supreme Court justices in a manner that is designed to kind of de-escalate these fights. What I suggest in the book is I try to strike a balance, right? On the one hand, we need the type of realism you're talking about, right? We need to fully and forthrightly confront just how nakedly authoritarian this type of politics is and how, you know, fundamentally at odds and contemptuous of basic democratic values it is, right? But on the other, we can't give up on the idea of fair play entirely, right? And so what I suggest is escalate where appropriate, but try to de-escalate where possible, right? So I really like these commissions, these independent commissions that as a means for checking gerrymandering. We can get to a point. Democrats can kind of stand for a compromise on voting access, which essentially says, "Look, you want voter ID? Fine. It's got to be done in a way that simply does not disenfranchise in any way, shape, or form. It's not a barrier to voting. but we'll give you that as long as it's on that condition, and you give us ease of voting access. And so that's what sort of, we got to get the balance right. It can't just be, we can't just follow the right over a cliff into procedural nihilism. We have to stand for something a little bit more, I think, judicious and balanced. But that, but at the same time, the trick is to do that without unilaterally disarming. And that's a hard balance to strike, and it'll be something that develops over time. But I think there are ways to get it right.
Well, when I brought up earlier that winning the trifecta in 1992 and in 2008, where the Democrats had the House, the Senate, and the White House, and they didn't get a lot done, it would seem to me that if it ever comes back, and it's a heavy lift, you know, maybe they'll get the Senate. The polls indicate otherwise. And right. The House, yeah, there's a chance, that good chance they'll get the House, but not by the margins that people are talking about. So I don't know what it's going to take for them to get back to the position where they can actually enact some countermeasures against this inexorable move on the counter-majoritarian move on the part of the Republicans controlling the Senate ad infinitum, and by controlling the Senate, of course, they control the courts. The first thing that, to my mind, that they should do if they do get the majority again is make Puerto Rico a state and make Washington, D.C. a state. And then I think there's something, I don't know how you get this state compact going to get rid of or to neutralize the Electoral College. It's, a lot of states have signed up to it. It's a way around a constitutional amendment. I don't know how you'll get the red states to sign onto it, but what's your understanding about that, Greg, that move at a state level to neutralize the
relic? Well, I agree with you on the, you know, on Puerto Rico and D.C. Like, those have to be, you know, serious considerations. I think the Electoral College thing is, it's frankly a lot tougher to imagine it succeeding, and I don't know that we need to. Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see what happens in the next couple of presidential elections. I'm not persuaded that we know this is going to happen again, although, or what happened with Trump and with Bush in the near future, although it could. I just think that's a bit of a faraway concern right now. And, you know, we need to be focused a little bit more on stuff that's actually achievable. You know, what I say in the book is that winning on the state level is really something that could go a long way over time to changing things, right? If we can get automatic voter registration in more states, that especially into the swing states, right? Not saying this is easy, but if we could start to get that, you know, this becomes a major disarming, this amounts to a major disarming of efforts to suppress the vote. Doesn't solve the problem, but it really helps, right? You know, and then, like you say, we have to think big in terms of things like Puerto Rico and D.C. The Electoral College strikes me as a tougher one.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Good conversation.
Thank you. And I've been speaking with Greg Sargent, who writes the Plumline blog at The Washington Post. Previously, he wrote for New York Magazine, The New York Observer, Talking Points Memo, and numerous political websites. And his latest book just out is An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time one night.